Welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Pastor Dusty White, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune, lead pastor of Coramdale Church, and Chris Hemmelman, lead pastor of First City Church. And every Wednesday, we have the privilege of sitting down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about how not to be secular, which is a title actually ripped off from a book, correct, Bob?
Yes, James K.A. Smith wrote a book with that title. I recently did a lecture on that book for our Porterbrook, Omaha students. I think the full lecture will probably be online by the time this podcast releases. You'll be able to find it at cdomaha.com or at bobthune.com. So the full lecture is like a three-hour, you know, deal. But we wanted to summarize in about 20 or 25 minutes some of the key observations of this book and of the lecture that I did on it for this reason. We live in a secular age. That's the sort of thesis of the book. But what that means is nuanced. And it's important that we understand what is true about the age we live in. Here's how I said it to the Porterbrook students. All of us are missionaries, and missionaries live in a certain context. And so what we're called to do is take the unchanging message of the gospel and connect it to the cultural context that we live in. And if we don't have a right understanding of our context, we can't be effective missionaries. And so just like we want a clear understanding of the gospel, we want to have good theology and doctrine, we want to be clear on what the gospel is, we need to be equally clear on what our culture is. And I use the metaphor of maps and said, you know, if I had a map of Omaha in 1970, it would still be functional. I could get to most places in the city, especially in the city center. But man, there'd be whole neighborhoods in the suburbs that wouldn't even be on that map. There might be whole, like the West Dodge Expressway wouldn't even exist on that map. Like there's whole streets and developments that would not exist there. And in the same way, Christians, I find, tend to be living with a cultural map that's probably 30 or 40 years outdated. And so James K. Smith wants to update our cultural map. And this book that he wrote, How Not to Be Secular, is a summary of a book by Charles Taylor called A Secular Age. Charles Taylor is a Canadian philosopher and a very dense, academic, brilliant man. And James K. Smith sort of distilling down Taylor's insights for us to help us understand the age that we live in. So my contention is if we understand what these guys are saying, it will help us be better students of our culture and therefore better missionaries within the culture.
Yeah, and I think it's helpful too because Smith's motivation here is he really wants pastors and leaders and Christians to understand this because we're intrigued with being apologetic, he says, but the Secular Age book is so dense that like you're not going to go read it. So he's really
passionate. I can't even read
here.
It. It's dense. And I was like, I usually read pretty high level books. And I was like, this is dense, man. I can't get through this.
I love his recommendation. Go read Derrida for a while and then come back and read Taylor. As one who had to read Derrida for grad school, I'm like, oh my gosh.
Like that doesn't sound like fun.
Yeah, it does not sound like fun. If
yeah.
All right. So let me give a few. I mean, I want to try to keep this as basic as I can, but let me give a few handles here. Taylor's point is this. When he says we live in a secular age, he says your average new atheist, here's what they want to do. They want to say, yep, you live in a secular age, and you, Christian, your beliefs are now in the past. They're outmoded. They're outdated. They have no place in the society we live in. The public square especially should be a naked, secular space. No religion is allowed here. No faith commitments are allowed here. It should be a sort of purely faith-free public square. Charles Taylor says that's a classic story that you're going to hear from almost every new atheist. And, you know, I have atheist friends that try to use that sort of logic all the time. He says that's not what we live. That's not the age that we live in. What it means that we live in a secular age, Taylor wants to redefine the word secular. He wants to say, here's what secular means. Secular means we live in an age where every claim about God or religion is contested and contestable. And that's never been true in the history of the world before. In pre-modern societies, everybody took it for granted that there was a God or a deity or a world beyond ours, a transcendent reality. And so we've never before lived in a world where any claim that God exists or any claim of religion is contested and contestable. He says that's what secular means. It doesn't mean that we're living in an age where religion is past due. In fact, if you look around the world, religion is increasing everywhere. So it's flatly not true that the world is more secular than it has been. However, it is true that religious claims are now contested and contestable in a way that they never have been before. And that's sort of the core of his argument. So he wants to say, we're living in sort of a different cultural space than we ever have. In Charles Taylor's account, and therefore Smith's summary, here's what that means for us as Christians. The fact that we live in this secular age where beliefs about God are contested, it means that everybody is haunted. Believers are haunted by doubt, and unbelievers are haunted by belief. So he says, if you listen to the average new atheist or the average fundamentalist Christian, they want to paint the world as though the unbelievers are in this corner and the believers are in this corner. He said, that's not the world we live in. We live in a world where all the believers are sort of haunted by the specter of doubt because the world's been disenchanted. And we realize, man, there's persuasive arguments against the existence of God that carry some weight and that perplex us. And at the same time, every unbeliever is haunted by belief. There's a sense in which they're persuaded that there is something beyond them, and there's a longing for transcendence that they can't fully reckon with. And so for us to be good missionaries in this world, we have to understand it's not two camps, unbelievers over here, believers over here. It's everybody in this same matrix where we're all sort of tempted and haunted by both unbelief and belief at the same time. Let me give you two angles on how we got here. Two helpful metaphors from Taylor, okay? And again, Taylor's a super dense person, but I think these distill it down into graspable concepts. First, he talks about the porous self versus the buffered self. He says, in pre-modern societies, the self was considered to be porous. In other words, I could be haunted by a demon. I could be filled with the Spirit of God. I could have mystical experiences where I encounter God. The self was porous. I was open to the supernatural influences for good or evil. Now we live in an age where the self is buffered. Think of the self, your sort of sense of self, as having a hard shell around it where I'm impervious to any sort of outside influence. I am, you know, I'm a rock, I'm an island, to quote Simon Garfunkel. So he says what that creates then is that solves some problems because we're not as concerned about can this person be demonized or can they be haunted by some spirit or specter or, you know. So it solves some problems, but it creates a whole new set of problems because actually none of us are made to live as though we're isolated, independent, non-transcendent beings. And so it creates this sense of imprisonment almost in ourselves. The second metaphor that I want to give you from Charles Taylor is that he calls it the imminent frame. And when I taught this at Porterbrook, I actually used to use a picture frame to describe this. He says, if you think about a picture frame both boxes in and boxes out. Some things are in that frame, some things are outside of the frame. He says the sort of cultural reality we live in is where the only thing that gets in the frame is imminence, what's right here and now. And what we've boxed out is the sense of the transcendent. So any sense that there's something beyond us, something bigger than us, the transcendent in the biggest sense of the word, whether we mean God or whether we mean meaning or whether we mean beauty or whether we mean anything beyond our present right now life. And so because we live within this imminent frame, we have these longings for transcendence that are unrealized. And because we have this buffered sense of ourselves, we have this longing for deeper meaning that we can't seem to achieve. And so what happens is we're longing for transcendence, but we can't get it. And so what you this is, James K. Smith is very connected to sort of popular culture. So he uses examples from like bands like Arcade Fire or Death Cab for Cutie. When I taught at Porterbrook, I used the Mumford & Sons song and a John Mayer song. He says, if you listen to good music, you find this sort of hauntedness, this longing for transcendence, this sense of like, isn't there something bigger than myself for me to live for? Isn't there some meaning outside of my reality that means something? Those are the questions unbelievers are asking, and those are the questions believers are asking. He's saying we're sort of all inhabiting this imminent frame together. I think that's really helpful for understanding the cultural world that we live in, because I've found, man, the people, like my new atheist friends who are like in the sort of like Christopher Hitchens is the Pope kind of camp, you know, like, what else do we need to talk about? Richard Dawkins has already proved that there's no God. And so you religious people are just hanging on to some weird superstition. Those are like such a small minority of the people in our city. the average person, whether they're religious or irreligious, has this sort of sense of like, I have a vague sense that there's something more to life. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what to do about that. I don't know if that's God or if it's something besides God, but there's this sense I have that life has to be about something more, but I'm not exactly sure what. That, yeah. I think, describes the city we live in.
Yeah, and since I'm not sure, I'm just going to not engage.
Yeah.
Right.
So this is causing me to think back in... So one of my grad classes, when I was at the University of South Dakota, I took an elective on world religion and conflict, and we spent a good portion of the class debating the secularization hypothesis. Is the world becoming more secular, or is it becoming more religious? And so we sort of read arguments on both sides. And so I'm always fascinated by this because, in one sense, if you look at like Europe, you can say, okay, there's obviously a much more secularized society. In the U.S., we have this weird kind of pockets of both secularization and still strong religious foundation. So I'm just curious, Bob, as you think through this, like you mentioned in Omaha, that's kind of the hardcore atheist is a small percentage. But as a church, as we're thinking through engaging our context, like how does this come into the way that we do ministry and evangelize in our city? Like how do these categories help us think through the best way to speak into the culture in a way that, and then the gospel can come in and kind of inform the way we speak into the culture.
So this is interesting, Chris. Smith says, if you think of religion as the shape of someone's ultimate concern, then religion is on the rise everywhere. He says organized religion might be on the decline in places like Europe, but human beings always have some source of ultimate concern. And we are religious. We're worshiping beings. We have this tendency to long for something transcendent. Now, we can take technology and make that transcendent. We can take our family and like we're going to find meaning and significance in something. But what he's saying is that inclination is present in everyone, whether they acknowledge it or not. So here's how I think that helps us as missionaries. I think it helps us be able to say, okay, if everyone in our city is longing for transcendence in some way, if they're boxed in this imminent frame world where the here and now are the only things we really talk about, and yet there is a longing in every one of us for a deeper sense of meaning and significance and connection to the transcendent, mm-hmm. Here's what that means. It should affect how we think about the gathered worship of the church. It should affect how we think about the spaces that we inhabit. Because what he's saying is the more we can tap into that longing for transcendence, the more we can connect to that longing for meaning. And so, you know, he talks a lot about, like, think about the kinds of – here's the example I used at Porterbrook. I said, hey, we're two blocks from St. Cecilia's Cathedral, one of the most beautiful cathedrals in this part of the country. I said, leave here, go walk in the front door of that cathedral and see what happens. Here's what immediately will happen. You'll go silent. And you'll just be overwhelmed with sort of this sense of awe and transcendence. Like, that's a beautiful space. Now walk into the average supermarket church down the street and see if that same thing happens. It doesn't. Like, so there's something that's tapping this sense of transcendence in us in a way that gets underneath our defenses. And so Smith's going to push on us as Protestants especially to say we need to think about how we engage space, mm-hmm. how we create transcendent experiences that are not toying with people's emotions, but that really do pull them into the sense that there's something bigger going on, there's something deeper going on, there's something beyond that I'm connected to right here. I think that, you know, Eric Goodell and I were just talking about, hey, so in worship, like in what we do in musical worship, we have a chance to do something there of just creating transcendent, meaningful experiences, even in just how we arrange music. And churches that are not doing that, I think, are going to be less and less evangelistically effective because you're not hooking into that longing. So it's funny if you think about sort of the church growth movement and sort of the pragmatism of like, well, here's five ways to make your marriage better and three ways to be better at work. And, you know, here's principles, blah, blah, blah. That stuff doesn't have any power for the average millennial who's longing for a sense of transcendence. And they go to church where they expect to find something transcendent. And all they get is sort of like best principles, you know, best practices for life. We're missing a chance to actually hook into something here that's, I think, deep in people's consciousness.
So does Taylor talk about where people go for this sense of transcendence? If they're not getting it through religious faith? Where are they going?
Here's the fascinating thing. He says, this is like an aside in Taylor, but I found out one of the most fascinating things he says. He says, lowercase a art has become capital A art. Hmm. He says, if you think about art in the Renaissance, it was always connected to worship and liturgy. Like the best artists were, you know, Michelangelo did the Sistine Chapel. It's a religious space, right? It's beautiful art and it's always connected to religion. Well, when art became unhinged from sort of a liturgical context, what's happened for us is James K. Smith uses this language of the aesthetic register. He says there's something about art or about the arts that taps into this sense of the transcendence. When we are missing, when we unhinge that from religion, art sort of becomes the only place we can find that. And that's why I think people are so captivated by movies, so captivated by music, so captivated by fine art, is because it does hook us into this sense of like, man, there's something big, there's something transcendent here. And that, like, if you've ever been to a concert, like I went to, you know, like a good concert where everybody's caught up in the music, there is this sense of like, man, it's transcendent in here. Like, this is better than just like, I like this song. This is like, there's something big going on here. And that's one of the most profound things I think Taylor observes, is that transcendence is now sought in art, in music, in film, in these sort of wrinkles in our culture where we still do sense this sort of connection to something beyond us.
It's pretty transcendent when you listen to Adele, isn't it, Dusty?
Only if they turn the mic on at the Grammys.
Yes.
Right, with their sound guy. That's fascinating right there, Bob, when you talk about it being unhinged, because now the very people that would say, you know, I want nothing to do with religion are the artists, right? Like, mm-hmm. They're the ones trying to create this flat culture.
So let me bring it down to street level with some of the how. Taylor gives two things. He says, there's two ways to inhabit the imminent frame that we find ourselves in. He calls them takes and spins, as in, let me give you my take on something, or let me give you a spin. You know, let me sell you a spin on something. He says, here's the two spins you're going to keep hearing. The fundamentalist spin, which is like, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. And the new atheist spin, which is, you religious people are all backwards and dumb, and we've moved up beyond that. He says neither of those are going to be persuasive to thoughtful people, because they realize that neither one of those answers all the questions. And so he's jealous for Christians to offer a take on things. I call Taylor's method suggestive apologetics, because what he wants to do is he wants to find the cracks in the imminent frame. He wants to find the questions that people don't feel like are answered well. And he wants to say, can I give you the Christian take on that? Can I give you can I suggest how the Christian worldview maybe better answers that question? And I've found that to be a really fruitful apologetic strategy, just to go that route and say, hey, I understand the question you're asking. Let me give you from the Christian worldview how I think it actually gives us more there than a sort of base secularist understanding of life.
It totally changes the argument, because then you're not going right, wrong, or like competition. You're going, hey, let me give you this angle.
Yeah, and that's what Taylor's saying, is like, that's what's persuasive to people, is a take on things that makes them go, that does answer some things that the other take on things doesn't. Here's some other sort of practical stuff. I ended the lecture at Porterbrook with 8 principles for Christian mission. I want to just summarize a couple of them because I think they're helpful. I think we should expect to see young evangelicalisms continue to flirt with Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, and high church traditions. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of that among sort of younger evangelicals. And I think what it is it's the longing for transcendence. It's that sense that like my church that meets in a shopping mall and sings like radio songs isn't fulfilling my need to be connected to something divine. And so I go to a tradition that more fully does that. Now, I don't like those departures, because I think they're also departure from what I would consider to be a better and fuller understanding of the gospel, but they make sense to me. And I think we should expect to see that trend continue until evangelicalism recovers a higher sense of liturgy, a fuller connection to the transcendent. And therefore, I think that churches that have a more liturgical or transcendent ethos are going to flourish. I think that's not really like an option for us. I think if you're trying to plant a church in post-Christian culture, that's almost a must, because that sense of transcendence is meaningful to people in ways we can't put words to.
That's just totally different than 10, 15 years ago of like, hey, let's put the cookies on the bottom shelf for you and bring out the lights and the lasers.
Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
You're not captivating thinkers or critical people in that environment.
Another application that I think helps us is I said on in this lecture, we need to abandon the culture war metaphor, which you'll notice, you know, Ted Cruz is using that a lot in the sort of politics side of things. There's a lot of sort of culture war metaphor. You know, we got to win back the culture. That rhetoric doesn't work. Because it's polarizing, it's us versus them. It sort of goes into that my spin versus your spin zone. And Taylor says, "Hey, if we could see ourselves as fellow exiles, if our language could become, hey, I feel trapped in this imminent frame with you, and I'm not satisfied with this. Can I suggest a way out? Can I suggest why the message of the Christian gospel has answered some questions for me that other things haven't?" That sort of fellow traveler, fellow exile ethos, I think is the right way for Christians to engage the culture. And if we go combative, if we go culture war, if we go me versus you, my values versus your values, I just think we're going to continue to find that not being persuasive to the average person who does feel a longing for meaning, but isn't convinced that a Christian spin is persuasive. A final observation is, to learn, and this is what I instructed the Poor Brook students, learn to recognize the longing for transcendence. Mm-hmm. It's in music. If you listen carefully, it's in a lot of film, not every film, but a lot of film there. You can see these echoes of the longing for transcendence, the longing for meaning. And so wherever we see that, we should affirm it. We should say, yep, that longing points to something. That longing hints at something. And instead of saying, like, I just think the more we recognize that, and especially sort of culture, the more hooks it gives us to sort of connect to the gospel narrative. So again, I used some songs when I did the lecture to sort of give examples of that. I think any way we can see and connect to that longing for transcendence that people have, that's a really important way that we connect the gospel to their longings.
Which Mumford & Sons songs did you use?
I use Roll Away Your Stone. Mm. And the lyric in that song is fascinating. I'll read it to you. It's not as fun as listening to it. But you told me that I would find a hole within the fragile substance of my soul. And I have filled this void with things unreal. And all the while my character it steals. Darkness is a harsh term, don't you think? And yet it dominates the things I seek. It seems that all my bridges have been burned. You say that's exactly how this grace thing works. It's not the long walk home that will change this heart, but the welcome I receive with the restart. Now you can see Marcus Mumford, as I understand it, is a son of Christian parents. And so you can see that he has a sort of intuitive grasp of grace at the end of that section. But I'm fascinated by, he's saying, you told me that I would find a hole within the fragile substance of my soul. That's Pascal's Pensées right there.
Sure.
And I've filled this void with things unreal. And all the while, he's saying, I'm trying to fill this void with stuff, but it's not working. And my character, it's stealing. Like, he's connecting this, like, you know, if I was to summarize what he's saying, there's this longing for transcendence in my soul that I'm trying to pack full of stuff, and it's just not working. And so what do I do with that? And you're suggesting, it seems like this song is a dialogue, because he says, you say that's exactly how this grace thing works. So it's like he's dialoguing with a Christian or with someone who understands grace, and provoked by the fact that, like, you're suggesting there's a different answer. I'm not entirely convinced of it, but I hear what you're saying, and it's intriguing to me. Mm-hmm. So I think that songs like that express this longing for transcendence, they're saying something. They're saying something. In our own city, again, I told this story when I did the lecture, my friend Ed Marcel rebuked me for not listening to Conor Oberst, because he said, look, if you're from Omaha, you should have every Conor Oberst album and listen to all of them, because that guy's saying something. That's what he said to me, is that guy's saying something in the songs he writes. You need to know what he's saying. He's asking questions. He's asking the right questions. He hasn't figured out what the answer is, but the questions he's expressing are profound. So again, that's just it was a good rebuke to me to go, yep, I need to be paying more attention to where these hints of transcendence are in our culture. So, guys, that's in whatever 25 minutes. The best summary I can do of a very dense book and a very good book that's a summary of that dense book. And then I told the Sportbook students, you're getting me summarizing James K. Smith, summarizing Charles Taylor. So you're sort of four layers downstream, and I apologize for whatever didn't make it through the filters. But I hope that's in some way helpful just as we think about how to engage a post-Christian culture with the gospel.
Yeah, and obviously the goal is so that we would engage and so that we would start to think more transcendently about everyday life, right? So that's going to do it for this podcast. And the goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, we invite you to listen in. And we pray that the things that we're talking about might also be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to talking at you again next week on the Wednesday Conversation.